Hello, everybody. Welcome to Chapter 6 of Librum of the DM. I'm Mike.
I'm DM Ed.
And I'm Saul.
Today is 4/29/2018. We're recording a day after our last episode. We're still going to talk a little bit about what we've done because I did have a gaming session this morning. So this morning, my group got together and we had a 5-hour gaming session, which I think went very well. Other than that, there's not much else that I've been doing. What about you two?
I've actually taken a hiatus from a couple games, just due to scheduling. One of them being DM Mike's. I've stepped out of that a little bit, so I'm not exactly sure what happened with this game this morning. But the game that I am still in, we've been investigating a necromancer's castle, and we're going through clearing little satellite towns around it that he's been attacking and converting the folks into zombies. That's been pretty interesting. We haven't gotten to the castle yet, so we're yet to see exactly what the players do to get inside of there, but so far it's been entertaining.
As for me, I haven't really had anything since yesterday. I have a game tonight at 8 o'clock Eastern time, but that's pretty much it.
And now let's move on to our listener questions. Our first question is from Zach Navain Duarden. He asks, have any of you thought of capturing the essence of a campaign and turning it into a story?
My answer would be yes. I have thought of it before, and I even went so far as to start writing a book when I was in high school, but I got to about 10 pages, and then I just had this massive amount of writer's block where I was just like, how on earth do authors do this? And I tried again probably 15 years ago and didn't even get past like 4 or 5 pages, and then I just said, you know, this obviously is not going to happen.
Yeah, I thought about making some of my campaigns stories, but unfortunately, I don't have the writing skill I think it needs to put my campaigns into a story mode. I have notes. I have all of my campaigns recorded at some point. They're more like journal entries and bullet points, and I just don't know how to expand on that. But I would love to see my campaign turned into a story.
Mine is actually the entire reverse of this. In early high school and middle school, I enjoyed writing and reading fantasy. So I, with a group of 3 other friends, ended up writing a small novel about this world that I ended up converting into the D&D world that I DM in. And I just kind of picked up a couple years after the book left off.
That's a really cool idea. I like that.
It worked out better than I expected it to.
I did the reading of books and put a lot of ideas together for some of my games, but never gone the other way around and turned them into anything more than journal entries.
Yeah, and I even try to sort of layer my play-by-post games that I DM kind of like a book where each adventure is its own chapter, per se. But I don't think it would read like a book just because it's straight up how everybody is responding in-game. And I don't think it would make a good novel of any kind.
So we all want to have our campaigns turned into stories, but fortunately none of us is talented enough to do so. Moving on to his next question, he is asking, in face-to-face gaming, do you encourage and or reward players for bringing in props, dressing the part, acting out parts? I played in a game where the GM had a stage he'd laid out, and he'd call players up from time to time to act out what they were doing when interacting with NPCs. As a GM, I love including props and the likes for other players. How do we feel about this?
Well, I've never required people to use props, and in most cases, nobody did use props. There was only a couple of different gaming groups that I have played with in the past, and one guy who played a cleric, he would always wear what I would classify to be a pimp hat. It was a purple kind of leopard color, and it had a feather sticking out the top. He called his cleric hat. And then I had another guy that I used to play with back in high school. He would usually take out one of his swords because he used to collect swords, and he wouldn't really do a lot of acting out per se with it, but he would always have it almost like it was just his D&D nerd item to have with him.
I've only had one player bring in props for himself. He would dress his part. He was running a druid, so he had this long brown robe that he would wear with a little gold tie around the waist. Other than that, any of the props that have come into my games have come from me. Back in the day, I used to bring in some little small novelty items from the dollar store, like rings or necklaces or little jewels, and I would pass them off as magic items. So then the players every week would gather their items, and then they would know, they'd have that visual reference of what they had on their character that was magical. Because a lot of times, for whatever reason, my players tend to forget what's on their character sheet. Another thing that I've done in the past is I would create a map or I would create a scroll and I would soak it in coffee overnight so it would give it that parchment look to it. And then I would like do a little burning around the edges to make it appear authentic. I don't do that anymore because A, I don't have time, and B, nobody really seemed to appreciate it as much as I did.
I like the coffee scroll idea. I'm going to try that at least once. On that note, I've never required props. Eventually, I'd like to get some props and start handing them out like what you did, bringing just dollar store gems and rings and whatnot. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. I also have only had one player that really cared to bring props, but then once nobody else was doing it, he just kind of stopped after a couple sessions. Everybody else just kind of shows up and they have a pencil and a character sheet, and sometimes they don't even have the pencil. They call it good.
I think that's more or less the standard group. I haven't played with too many groups where I knew anybody who liked to dress up or even DM'd for a group who dressed up or brought in props. I don't have a problem with it. If people want to, by all means do so. I guess I don't necessarily encourage it, though. I don't say, hey, everybody bring in props next week. But I'm not going to say, hey, that's a little weird, back off. I actually like the idea of players getting into character a little bit and enhancing the game a little bit.
Yeah, and I've never even had anybody give bonus experience points for the people that did want to have a prop. And I even have played in a LARP group once doing Vampires of the Masquerade, and we didn't even really dress up as much as they depict in LARPing groups. We just mostly wore trench coats and were vampires.
Well, I encourage players to get into character, so since I reward them for writing journals about what's happened in previous sessions, I probably would reward them with bonus experience if they came in with more props for their characters. So I think that answers that question. Let's move on to our next question, which is from Satendra Marquis. He was a guest on our last episode. He asks, how do you guys handle unarmed combat? I use a slightly modified version of martial arts from the Oriental Adventures, which is a TSR 2018 book. When a PC specializes in a form of martial arts, they get special abilities. I have a post and a link to the charts I use, but one thing that they get is the ability to actually hurt creatures that require magical bonuses to hit them.
I've never used any special rules or like significantly altered the handling of unarmed combat. Usually it's you take the proficiency of martial arts or wrestling or whichever one it is that you want to use, and then you roll to hit or you use whatever the rules are. Like in wrestling, I know that they added a couple extra rules in some of the players' options for that. I've never had a player really specialize in it, so I guess I've never had to worry too much about altering beyond just what's in the books.
Yeah, for me, I haven't really had a whole lot of people that are trying to fight unarmed. Most of the time, they are using their weapons. But otherwise, I just refer to the information that is in the player's handbook. On the revised edition, it's on 128, where it's got the punching and wrestling information, overbearing. I like to pretty much use those, because in most cases that I have encountered, it's been they just wanted to beat the opponent till they were unconscious, and then they were going to use them basically as a prisoner to get some information out of
them. Yeah, I'm not really one to do much with the open hand combat. Very few of my players actually use it. I am not familiar with the Oriental Adventures that he's talking about, but I may have to check it out and see if the rules are better than what I use. I use what's found in the Combat and Tactics. It's a very basic system. They punch, wrestle, or whatever, and they have a small percentage chance of doing some critical damage. But typically it's 1 to 2 points of damage, and then rolling that percentage. But I'm always open to new ideas, so I will check this out, and I'll report back in a future episode.
I wonder if the information he's referring to is still in the original first edition Oriental Adventures books.
I didn't think to go look, so we can check on that as well. So that wraps up our player questions. I hope they all got answered. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to leave us an email at librumofthedm@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Google community page, which is Librum of the DM, and or leave us a message on our Podomatic. Moving on to our first section, we are going to talk about Thief and Rogue class kits, the Troubleshooter and the Investigator. I personally love both of these kits. I like that they added something into the book that didn't necessarily require a rogue to be your stereotypical rogue, which runs around stealing and backstabbing and opening and picking locks. They gave them a purpose. They're both on the side of the law and working against your standard thieves and rogues guilds.
Yes, and they are probably the most hated types of thieves, too, because they're the complete opposite of what most thieves in the Thieves Guild would be.
Allowing a character to expand on rogue skills and benefit the general public seems to be very ingenious to me. I like the fact that they allow a player to, I'm going to be an investigator, I'm going to work on the side of the law and see if I can find some of these rogues or thieves, or the troubleshooter who's just, hey, you put all these traps in place to keep people out, let me test it for you, and I can determine if it's a good quality system or if improvements need to be made.
I like them a lot because I've always felt awkward rolling thieves and then making them lawful anything. As a thief, the entire basis is that they're contradicting and going against the laws and the way that things are supposed to function. I really like them because for role-playing purposes, even if you want to just be a dungeon delver, you could roll the troubleshooter, and your job is disarm traps, and your job is to sneak through things, and as you were saying, go through and the general premises test systems, but if you want to, you could say, hey, I'm a lawful, good troubleshooter thief. For those purposes is something that I really, really like.
And actually, even with the troubleshooter, you could actually be part of this, one of the thieves' guilds. And you go around checking on security and trying to give them, you know, improvement ideas. But then later on, you're actually coming back because you were casing the place to see if you could get in and steal something that they had.
That's an amazing plot point. I like that.
I'm not so sure that you could pull the same thing off as an investigator, but it's possible you could also be investigating something and trying to case the joint in advance, saying you're working for the law and then rob the place later.
I think it's funny that under the kit description, there's no special benefits or hindrances for either of these classes except for role-playing elements. They say that the troubleshooter is kind of one who, if something can go wrong, it will. So that is both a positive and a negative for that particular class. It is a role-playing aspect, so it requires a little bit of effort on the DM's part, but it's still really entertaining to me to see that these kits were included. And they have all of these neat little role-playing enhancements to them. These two are kits that are most often taken in my campaign because they give a little bit of bonuses, but the players don't have to, like Saul said, they don't have to be the evil backstabbing rogue. They can be actual lawful characters contributing to a party and society. I do also like the idea that they might, at night, go off and do things for the Thieves Guild and use what they're doing during the day as part of the Thieves Guild enhancement. But that, to me, is something a little more designed for a one-on-one campaign or more of an urban campaign, whereas the lawful aspect where they can join an adventuring group just makes them a little more enjoyable to play and a little more enticing to player characters. So have you guys had any of these kits played in any of your campaigns?
Yeah, surprisingly, I've only had one player use kits, and those were fighter kits. One used the barbarian kit, and then he also used the magician's kit for... I think it was for the cleric, but no, I've never had anyone use these.
Yeah, I haven't had anybody really use the kits that much at all. I have used the troubleshooter kit in one game that I can think of right now.
I've had both of them used over the years multiple times, and I myself have used one. My wife in the game that we're playing has one of her characters using the investigator kit to help her other two characters find things and get clues for what's going on. So that's our take on the troubleshooter and the investigator. Let us know if you've used them or how you've used them if you have. If you have any questions, feel free to get a hold of us. Moving on to the Pages of the Beast section, we're going to talk about the thiefly monsters. Bandits, brigands, thieves, thugs, and assassins.
Yes, and they can be found in the Monster Manual on page 196 under Human.
I think we all agree if we're using bandits, brigands, thieves, thugs, and assassins that they don't have to be just humans. Those are the guidelines and where the Monster Manual decided to put them. But you could make half-orcs, orcs, halflings, dwarves, elves. Any of those could definitely be any of these classifications.
Yeah, I would say that pretty much any race that can play a thief as a player's character should be able to be one of these as an NPC.
My take on them is they're great for low-level adventurers, maybe even some mid-level adventurers, where they're a good side track, where they're traveling through and a bunch of bandits come across them and try to rob them of their goods. They're low-level monsters with maybe a mid to high-level leader that could be the point of one of your adventures.
Yeah, and you can have them in more than just like a town or urban setting. You could have them on a road somewhere, maybe not necessarily in the woods, but you never know. You could find them almost anywhere.
Well, most of these would be found in Robin Hood's Merry Band of Men.
Well, I would also have them in other random places, too. Hey, look, a bandit just popped out of that alley over there.
Oh, yeah, they definitely have applications for an urban setting as well as an outdoor setting. I think you could probably find them anywhere in towns or in between towns.
Yeah, and actually we forgot one from the list that we could incorporate to this as well. Pirates or buccaneers could also be classified as somewhat thiefly.
Robbing on the high seas.
Most of them are pretty common, and you could use them in any setting. You got the pirates, you could have that encounter on the sea. You've got, you know, bandits, brigands, you could find those on a road, in a town, outside of a town gate, possibly outside of the range of where, you know, the normal constable or police town guard would happen to be patrolling. So they would know maybe even campsites that people tend to stop off on the roads and camp in the woods somewhere. You could really just throw them in anywhere. And they don't have to be a low level. You could always do like what I do, where just because the monster manual indicates that this would be a low level encounter, you could actually say, well, actually, this is a 10th level bandit gang that you just encountered, and you're all 10th level fighters or whatever.
I do that for assassins and thieves, but not so much for the bandits, brigands, and thugs that are sitting on the side of the road or inside of a town.
Most typically, I use them either as highwaymen, or you run into them fairly often if you go to the slums of some of the larger cities in my world, but I don't use them incredibly heavily. I think there's only been one bandit town, per se, that was in the game, and the players ended up just clearing that out.
A town of thieves. That reminds me of Skullport in Undermount.
I'll have to expand on that, because there are also pirates that the players have run into a couple of times. They just don't go seafaring very often, so I forget about it sometimes. But I do have pirates in the oceans as well.
Well, and you could even have a ship of pirates come and ambush a town docks area, you know?
So the Monster Manual has a lot of entries under the humans, being the bandits, brigands, thieves, thugs, and assassins. We're not going to read them all for this particular section. We just wanted to talk about their general purpose and their general use. So that's our take on bandits and brigands and thieves and thugs and assassins. If you couldn't tell, I'm enjoying saying that. If you have anything you'd like to add to this, maybe you've used them in a different way or have some suggestions for us, let us know. Moving on to our next section, we're going to the pages of the spellcasters. Today we're going to talk about spells that would be beneficial to a thief that might possibly also be a mage. Whether they are a thief mage class or they're getting help from a mage in the Thieves Guild, these are spells we feel would be helpful to them.
Yes, so we have two second level mage spells that we decided to talk about. One of them is Deep Pockets, and the other one is Alter Self. I have them in the player's handbook. They are on page 139 and 140 of the unrevised second edition player's handbook.
They're found on page 224, volume 1 of the Wizard's Spell Compendium. Well, let's learn a little bit more about the spells. DM Ed, you want to read the Deep Pocket spell to us?
Yes, okay, so this is a affecting one garment type spell that you have to actually touch. And the duration of the spell is 12 hours plus 1 hour per level. It takes a whole turn to cast the spell. It's an alteration enchantment spell. What this spell does is enables the caster to prepare a garment so that it can hold far more than it normally could. A finely sewn gown, robe of high quality materials, maybe even a cloak with pockets on it, can contain numerous hand-sized pockets. One dozen is the minimum number. The deep pocket spell then enables these pockets to hold up to a total of 100 pounds, 5 cubic feet in volume, as if it were only 10 pounds of weight. So it not only increases what it can carry, it makes it so that it's much lighter than the actual weight would be. Furthermore, there's no discernible bulges where these special pockets are. At the time of the casting, the caster can instead choose to have 10 pockets, each holding 10 pounds, which would be a half cubic foot volume each. If the garment is sewn with 100 or more pockets, holy moly, that would be a lot. The 100 pockets can be created to contain 1 pound of weight and 1/6 a cubic foot. The actual pocket is actually an extra dimensional holding space. If the spell duration expires, there's material within the enchanted pockets, or if a successful dispel is cast upon the garment, all the material suddenly appears around the wearer and immediately falls to the ground. The caster can also cause all of the pockets to empty with a single command. In addition to the garment, which is reusable, the material components of the spell are tiny golden needle, a strip of fine cloth, given a half twist and fastened at the ends.
This seems like a very fun spell. I can see many uses for it in an urban setting, maybe not so much in a dungeon setting unless you know the time allotment is going to match. I can imagine a thief getting caught, being sent to prison, standing there like, I didn't steal anything, having the spell expire, and all of a sudden having everything around him, just all of his pockets empty, and he's caught red-handed with all of these items he stole.
I enjoy it because unless you're in combat, one turn isn't too much time to burn casting a spell, and it's incredibly useful for, I guess as you were saying, for very urban settings. It's like having a bunch of tiny bags of holding attached to you, and that alone amuses me. Other than that, it does greatly increase your carrying capacity, and I can see it having a fair amount of uses even in dungeon delving. If you'd stay on top of it, you should be able to recast it before it expires, even if you're in a dungeon. So I don't see that being too big of a problem. Just have a couple castings on you. At least 24 hours will pass, and then you should have time to meditate while the pockets are still active to get the castings back.
Yeah, but it would be incredibly hilarious to be caught with the spell expiring and then just the garment all just rips apart because of all the weight of stuff falling out of these pockets.
Yeah, you could cast a spell every night at camp, providing that you're high enough level and it hasn't expired within the time since you last rested. I think that requires a level 12 caster in order to do a 24-hour period.
Yeah, I could see that you could use it as long as you knew you would be back into a place where you could unload everything that you took in the pockets before the spell expires, because you wouldn't have to just necessarily be in an urban setting or even a small town setting where you plan on robbing the mansion that the town mayor lives in or something, you know?
Yeah, it would have to be planned out ahead of time, knowing you're going to be in and out of the dungeon within the time limit of the spell, or within maybe an extra casting of the spell. If you're going on a long adventure campaign-wise, it's really not going to be that beneficial because you don't want it halfway in combat to have all of your items strewn all about the floor.
Yeah, you would want to have a pack mule as backup.
The other alternative is to pay a wizard to cast a permanency spell on it so it's always full of its deep pockets.
Yeah, but the cost of making it permanent is probably something that you wouldn't even be able to afford right off.
That is probably true. If I remember from the first edition game when they listed prices for wizards to cast spells, that was a 10,000 gold piece casting. Permanency is a very high level spell, and it does take a constitution point away from the wizard casting it.
Which would explain its steep cost.
So that's our take on deep pockets. Moving on to our next spell, we're going to talk about Alter Self. This is found on page 180 of the Revised Player's Handbook, and also page 36, volume 1 of the Wizard's Spell Compendium.
And page 139 of the Unrevised, if you still have the original Player's Handbook for 2nd edition.
Alter Self. This is a level 2 spell that basically affects the caster. Its components are verbal and somatic, so there's no material requirements. Casting time is 2. This spell will last 3d4 rounds, plus 2 rounds per level of the caster. And the air effect is only the caster, and he does not get a saving throw versus a spell he wants to put on himself, which makes sense. When this spell is cast, the wizard can alter his appearance and form, including clothing and equipment, to appear taller, shorter, thin, fat, or in between, human, humanoid, or any other generally man-shaped bipedal creature. The caster's body can also undergo a limited physical alteration, and his size can be changed up to 50%. If the form selected has wings, the wizard can actually fly, but only at 1/3 of the speed of a true creature of that type, and with a loss of 2 maneuverability classes to a minimum of E. If the form has gills, the caster can breathe underwater as long as the spell lasts. However, the caster does not gain any multiple attack routines or additional damage allowed to the assumed form. The caster's attack rolls, armor class, and saving throws do not change. The spell does not confer special abilities, attack forms, or defenses. Once the new form is chosen, it remains for the duration of the spell. The caster can change back to his own form at will, but this ends the spell immediately. A caster who was slain automatically returns to his normal form.
So once again, this would be great, especially if you're a mage thief that didn't take disguise as a non-weapon proficiency. You've got a spell that can do that just for you, and probably work even better than your normal disguise non-weapon proficiency skill would do. But you would not want to be caught when it runs out.
It can also be used to maybe create gills so you can dive into the river running through town to get away from the town guard. Or if you can get wings, maybe you can fly off and get out of the range of their missile weapons or any of their attacks.
albeit you would be doing it at one-third the typical speed of whatever flying creature you alter yourself to be.
This could also have the advantage of shape-changing into the mayor. You look like the mayor, you walk into his mansion, you grab a couple things, shape-change into something else with your deep pockets, and walk out with all of the items and nobody's the wiser.
See, now you're combining both spells together. That's really smart right there.
The value of this spell is pretty much limited to your imagination. It's left pretty open-ended as far as what you can do with it. If you're disarmed by the guards, you can easily grow talons or grow yourself a beak and use an unarmed weapon that way. You can grow gills and swim away. You can fly away with wings, as Mike was saying. You can change your size up to 50%, so if you need to, if you're trying to hide, you can easily just shrink yourself down to half your total size and then climb into a box or something. If they're looking for a 5.5-foot tall man, a small 2.5-foot tall halfling is going to pretty easily get by them.
And being that the spell is only verbal and somatic, that means that they don't need a material component, so if they get captured and all their items stripped away, they could still change into something to maybe squeeze between the bars, get out of the whatever handcuffs or shackles they're in, and basically just use it to get away.
That's very true. If you're going to play a thief, like a sneak thief, I would probably recommend having this thing memorized if it's available to you. Just even if you never use it, the one time that it's useful, it's probably going to change the course of what's happening.
One of my characters in my current game found a uniform that is magically enchanted with Alter Self. So at will, he can change himself into getting wings. He's changed himself into spider legs to climb a wall. He's done a lot of creative things with this spell, and I'm almost regretful of giving it to him, but it's also entertaining watching him come up with fun ideas of how to use the spell to benefit the party.
Yeah, I can actually think of a player from back when I used to play a lot of face-to-face games that if his character was able to alter himself, it would have got him out of a lot of the trouble he always got himself into.
So yeah, it's definitely a useful spell. I think it's more beneficial to a rogue than an actual wizard. So that's our take on Deep Pockets and Alter Self. If you have any stories to share with us, we'd love to hear them. If you have any suggestions on how you've used them, we'd love to hear those as well. Moving on to our next section, we're looking at our footnotes. We're going to talk about non-weapon proficiencies for thieves. They're found on page 16 of the Complete Thief's Handbook. First one we're going to talk about is locksmithing. This is found on page 19 of the Complete Thief's Handbook. It takes one slot, requires a dexterity check, has no modifiers, and is recommended for the troubleshooter, dwarf, and gnome thieves.
Yes, this is a specialized skill for making locks. It's pretty much treated like other craft proficiencies. When you check for success, it works the same way. If a thief is with this proficiency, they gain a 10% bonus to their lockpick skill, so that also is additionally helpful to a thief, because they're going to be intimately familiar with the inner structure and the works of a lock and locking mechanisms, so many locks would be much easier for them to pick. Besides troubleshooters, dwarf and gnome thieves of any kit can take the locksmithing proficiency to fill one slot because of the tradition of craftsmanship in mechanical things in their cultural heritage.
I don't think I've had a thief not take the skill since the Complete Book of Thieves came out. It's an extremely beneficial skill, and it only takes one slot, so it benefits their lockpicking skills right off the bat.
The 10% bonus to their lockpicking is pretty big for as cheap as the skill is.
And it's just a 10% bonus. There's no skill check required to get that bonus. The skill check is meant for if they're creating locks or designing locks for a customer.
Yeah, so it enhances their picking skill without actually having to be an additional check on top of just the open lock skill.
Yeah, I really like what the Complete Thief's Book did for the thief, and it kind of enhanced them and made them a little more useful. And there's a lot of skills that they listed in the book that are beneficial to a thief.
Some of the additional non-weapon proficiencies in the Complete Thief's Handbook were actually available to some of the other classes only, and they just decided to give thieves access to this as well.
So that's the locksmithing skill. Let's move on to our next one, which is observation. This is found on page 19 of the Complete Thieves Handbook, requires one slot, takes intelligence, and has no modifiers.
And it's required for a beggar, cutpurse, investigator, spy, swindler, or troubleshooter. It's recommended for an assassin, bounty hunter, burglar, fence, or smuggler. Characters with this proficiency have cultivated exceptionally acute powers of observation. Characters with this proficiency have cultivated exceptionally acute powers of observation. The DM may ask for a proficiency check or secretly roll it himself or herself anytime there is something subtly askew. He may also allow characters with observation to increase their chance of finding secret or concealed doors by 1 in 6. This proficiency covers all the senses.
This is the skill that eventually replaced the perception check for me. I used to use the perception stat, so they had 7 stats instead of 6, and I ended up getting rid of that and replacing it with this. So any character that wanted to see something that was out of the ordinary or observe some things that were subtly askew, they'd be able to take this stat and roll the dice instead of the perception check.
I actually require this for my players. I just give it to them passively and they can expand upon it if they want to. I find a pretty general tool for awareness. You're going through town, I'll say, hey, roll an observation check, and you notice there's something going on off in the distance that you wouldn't have noticed if it weren't for your peripherals, or you're sneaking through a dungeon and I tell one of the players to make an observation check, and then if they succeed, they hear something going on behind them and there's like a monster sneaking up on them or something along those lines. I don't really charge any of them for it. I don't actually make it take up a slot for them. But if they want to expand upon it, I'll let them take it and then give them a little boost for it. But I actually do require that players have this and just give it to them for free.
That actually makes a lot of sense to me. It's maybe something that I introduce into my campaigns. I think everybody has the ability to actually perceive something. It's based on intelligence. So if they have a low intelligence, they're not going to perceive things very often. But they're still going to occasionally see something that's not quite right.
But, you know, even for just the cost of one slot, that's not terribly bad because you get 3 initial non-weapon proficiencies when you start out at level 1 as a rogue.
Right, but if you're forcing players to take it because you want to use it for all the characters, it doesn't seem fair to take away one of their non-weapon proficiencies when they were not planning on taking it to begin with.
That is quite true. I don't think I would ever force it on anybody.
But if it is a stat you want to use as a standard for all characters, then you have to make adjustments for them so that they don't lose half of what they wanted to do with their character. Well, 1/3. So that's our take on observation and locksmithing. Let us know how you use them. Leave us an email at livermofthedm@gmail.com. Visit our Google community page or leave us a message on Podomatic. Our next section is the resources section where we want to discuss the Complete Thief's Handbook. We've already referenced it several times during the podcast here, but we'd like to go a little more in depth of talking about the book in general.
Yes, the Complete Thief's Handbook. It's semi-self-explanatory, but it's really handy if you happen to be in a game where the Dungeon Master allows you to use several of the additional source books, because this extends a bunch of the non-weapon proficiencies for thieves. It gives you some additional kits that you can choose to be besides just the standard player handbook, thief or rogue. And it also has a list of several different items that would be useful to use as a thief that aren't necessarily covered in the basic equipment that you can find in the player's handbook.
This was the first complete book that they actually came out with. I thought they did a really great job with it, even better than some of the ones that came out later where they already had a point of reference. But there's a lot of information in here that is beneficial to a thief, very helpful to a thief. I think the kits alone are very useful. I think there's only one or two that I haven't seen used in any of my campaigns. So I always encourage the thieves of my group to look through the books when they're rolling up their character and find a kit that kind of fits what they're looking for. We've even made a couple of our own kits that the players have used for a specific purpose in playing the rogue character.
What I found interesting in here too that I didn't mention is that it even gives you advice on how to roleplay a thief.
That is something that I think these books did really well at, all of them. They gave a lot of personalities and a lot of roleplaying suggestions for how a player could approach playing their character. Some of them may not ever be useful in a good aligned campaign, but I still think that these suggestions are helpful to a player rolling up a character so they get a general idea of how am I going to play this character? How does it fit with my backstory? Maybe one of these personalities does fit with my backstory and they can move from there.
Now, there's one section of this book that I noticed when I was looking at the table of contents the other day in it. I've never actually used this part, the new rules for rogues. Have you actually applied that at all, Mike?
When this book first came out, my players and I went through it pretty much with a fine-tooth comb. We did introduce some of these rules into our game. Some of them never really came into play that much, but I did read through it. We did incorporate some of them, and to this day, I do still use some of these, but I have adapted some new rules to replace some of them. We still use the poison antidote rules. We use the antidote effects. We use the effects of armor on acrobatic proficiencies for anybody taking the acrobat class. And we also use the armor and thief skill adjustments based on what armor they're wearing and how it affects their thief skills.
I think the only one that I really use is the armor one. At least the only one that I've really enforced consistently.
What's helpful is by using the core rules expansion 2.0, it automatically adds these in for you anyway. So it takes a lot of these rules, and if it affects the character sheet, it applies them automatically.
That's not really a resource we've talked about much, is it? May I have to expand on that someday.
We touched on it briefly yesterday with encumbrance rules, and yes, we should include it in one of our sections here soon.
Granted, it is an older piece of software that's been around for a while, and not everybody probably has it anymore.
And finding a copy online is really hard. When you do find one, it's not exactly cheap.
Probably my favorite addition to the repertoire of thieves added in this book is all of the equipment. There are things called water shoes, which you throw them on, they have a lot of surface area, and you can essentially just float down a river on them. If it's a calm pond or something, you can throw them on and you can just paddle across the water. There is something called a false scabbard, which it's designed for a short sword or a long sword, and it's slightly longer than what your sword actually is, and it has a small compartment in the bottom, so if you need to, you can tweak a key from a guard, throw it into your false scabbard, and then who's going to look in your sheath? They added grappling hooks to help you climbing up walls. They've added various weapons that you can easily hide, but then once you deploy them, they're like a hidden blade to be used in combat just as well as like a dagger or some basic knife. They've added the flashing powder where you throw it on the ground, it goes poof, and then you run away and everybody blinks and like, oh no, where did he go? And then they're all looking for you, but you're already gone because they were blind.
They did a great job adding a lot of items to this. I was really pleased to see that they kind of focused on the thief and gave you mostly items that a thief only would use. There are some items like the grappling hook that was mentioned. I think it's also listed in the player's handbook, but there's no description for it. But they also added in like caltrops and other things that anybody could use, but most beneficial to a thief who's trying to get away from somebody trying to catch him.
I'd have to say one of my favorites is the skeleton key has been added in this book.
So that's our overview of the Complete Thieves Handbook. I think we all agree that this is a very handy resource for a thief. You should check it out. Let us know what your favorite sections are or how you use the book. Now we're going to move on to our enchanted pages and talk about some magical items for thieves. One of the things we did mention in the last section is there's a nice list of thief magical items listed in this book as well. The first item we're going to talk about are the Boots of Balance. They are found on page 106 of the Complete Thieves Handbook, or page 193 of the Encyclopedia Magica, Volume 1.
Yes, these are boots that I actually picked out to talk about. The wearer is endowed with a magically enhanced sense of balance. They gain a 10% bonus to climb walls and move silently rolls. Dexterity is also enhanced by 1 point for all purposes where hands are not used. So you wouldn't be able to apply this to opening locks or finding and removing traps, because that would involve your hands. You would get the bonuses for armor class as well, depending on if you increase your dex enough that it would affect that. And it also will apply bonuses to different dexterity checks in certain situations, like if you're avoiding a fall. The wearer gains the tightrope walking proficiency as well, if this is not already possessed. But if they already have that non-weapon proficiency, they doesn't affect them in that at all. You get a -4 bonus modifier that applies to all proficiency check die rolls when wearing the boots. The wearer of the Boots of Balance cannot also claim further bonuses for moving silently or from mundane aids, such as use of leather strapping across the creaky floorboards. Also, the bonuses gained from the Boots of Balance cannot be added to the bonus gained if the wearer also uses the Gauntlets of Dexterity.
I don't think I've ever used these items in any of my campaigns. I can see where they'd be extremely useful for an urban rogue. Maybe not so much in a dungeon, except for the moving silently and sneaking part.
Well, what if they were going across one of those lumberjack pit traps? Maybe that tightrope walking skill would be beneficial to crossing a log.
Okay, it does have more applications than just the moving silently and hiding in shadows. But I just still think it would benefit an urban rogue much more than a dungeon delving rogue.
Yeah, I can see that as well, but I can see where some of its applications could be applied in other situations outside of an urban area.
I don't think any rogue would turn away a pair of these, though.
Well, unless they're getting the gauntlets of dexterity, then maybe they'd be like, yeah, I'll just pass on the boots. I want the gauntlets.
I like the boots of balance overall. I think for long term, I'd rather replace it with something else, simply because it doesn't stack with a lot of other items. And so with enough creativity and after enough time of acquiring other magical items or other mundane resources, you can exceed what the boots of balance are capable of.
As a DM, though, you can go in and edit these items to make them compatible with those, so you don't have to follow the books, which is one of the nice things about the game, is you can make any rule changes you want to make.
That's very true.
Or you could even make your own improved version of the Boots of Balance.
Which is kind of what they did with the Gauntlets of Dexterity, which is our next item we wish to talk about. This is found on page 503 and 504 of the Encyclopedia Magica, Volume 2, or page 169 of the Dungeon Master's Guide. A pair of these gloves appears to be nothing more than lightweight leather handwear of the everyday sort. Naturally, they radiate magic if detected magic is cast. They size themselves magically to fit any hands, from that of a huge human or to that of a small halfling. Gauntlets of Dexterity increase the overall dexterity by 4 points if the wearer's dexterity is 6 or less, or by 2 points if it's at 7 to 13, and by 1 point if the dexterity is 14 or higher. Furthermore, wearing these gloves enables the non-thief to pick pockets, 95% chance, or open locks, 37% chance, as if he or she were a 4th-level thief. If worn by a thief, they increase these two abilities by 10%. The improved version is found in the Encyclopedia Magica, page 503-504 also, and they automatically give the wearer an 18 dexterity.
These are really, really, really good.
And you can see why they wouldn't want you to combine them with the Boots of Balance, because you're getting a better benefit from the gauntlets than you are from the boots.
That is very true.
Except with the Boots of Balance, it affects your lower half, whereas the Gauntlets of Dexterity affect your upper half. You don't get benefits from the Boots of Balance for your pickpockets or open locks, but you do with the Gauntlets of Dexterity. But the Gauntlets of Dexterity will affect the lower half for the Move Silently, the Hiding in Shadows, and other abilities like that.
Yeah, but it also, you said in the improved version of it, is giving them an automatic dexterity of 18, which just seems a bit insane. If you're going to include the Boots of Balance with that and get an extra point, then you'd have a dexterity of 19.
And if you're using that version of the gauntlets, I would definitely make the Boots of Balance non-compatible with them. If you're using the other version of them, the one we read first, I would maybe combine the two, because Thief only has a 15 dexterity. All the gauntlets are going to do is give him a 16, which really doesn't increase his abilities that much.
Yeah, I like how this one is broken down by whatever your base dexterity is, it increases it however many points, where it's only 4 if you're at a 6 or less, which would actually be beneficial when we were talking in a prior episode about people playing characters with a lower stat.
Yeah, these definitely have applications to non-thief classes, unlike the Boots of Balance, which is pretty much exclusive to thieves. With the gauntlets, if you have a wizard with a lower dexterity, you don't want him having a penalty to his armor class, so you can give him this, and then kind of even that out.
Plus, now that wizard can go ahead and open a lock if they feel like trying.
If need be, yes.
Makes for a good backup thief.
Backup partial thief, anyways, because he's going to either open locks or pick somebody's pockets.
Yeah, or, oh, our thief just blew up. Hey, second string, you're up.
One thing, though, I am actually kind of surprised at is that it doesn't enhance your skill to finding or removing traps, which I would think you would be doing with your hands.
I think that's because you're using both your hands and your eyes.
And you might even be sort of using your ears, I suppose, but you could say the same with picking a lock. You're listening for that telltale click.
True, but most of the ability is done through your hands. I personally use the second version where it automatically gives the character an 18 dex. I feel it's equivalent to the Gauntlets of Ogre Power. If they can give a character an automatic 18-0-0 strength, why shouldn't the Gauntlets give a character an automatic 18 dexterity?
I've personally have not used any of them, but that is a fair consensus on the Gauntlets.
Yeah, I haven't incorporated either of these into any of the games that I've run, and I don't recall seeing them that often in any of the games I've played in either.
If you were to introduce one of these to your game, which one would you use?
Depending on the level, I suppose, of the characters, I might give the Boots of Balance for a lower level campaign and maybe the Gauntlets of Dexterity for slightly higher.
Same here, yeah.
But if you were using one of the two sets of Gauntlets of Dexterity, which one would you introduce into your campaign?
The original version versus the improved.
I would probably introduce the original version initially and then review it for future use, depending on how the first one goes down.
Or maybe you could include both of them, and some of them do this and some of them do that. That way you're not pigeonholed into one or the other.
Yeah, I could see that. Use the original one, and then maybe they get enhanced later on to the improved version. Or maybe you even happen to find the improved version on some other character that you defeated.
So that's our take on the Gauntlets of Dexterity and the Boots of Balance. I think they're both very beneficial for a rogue class. Not that other classes can't use them, but I think they would enhance the thief the most. Moving on to our next section, we're going to talk about the Tools of the Trades and the Missing Pages. These are found in Chapter 5, pages 90 to 108 in the Complete Thieves Handbook. Saul was talking a little bit about these earlier, but we'd like to pinpoint just a couple of them.
Yes, we have chosen Grappling Hooks and Weapon Black. And I have actually found that they're in more than one place. You've got them in the Complete Thieves Handbook, and they're also in the Arms and Equipment Guide. And the page in the Arms and Equipment Guidebook is 113 for Grappling Hook and 117 for Weapon Black. In the Complete Thief's Handbook, you can find Grappling Hook on page 95 and 96, and Weapon Black is on page 94.
Keeping in mind that the Grappling Hook is mentioned in the Player's Handbook, but it gives you absolutely no description.
Which is probably them thinking that it's self-explanatory, but at least the other two places that's mentioned kind of goes into a little bit more information on them.
I don't see Grappling Hooks as a thief-only weapon. I've had several parties that have taken it and used it very well. If you use it with a rope use proficiency, it gives you an even better bonus when using it. I know that it's beneficial to a thief, especially in a setting where you're trying to run away from the monsters that are chasing you, and being able to quick swing up your grappling hook and climb out of danger is definitely beneficial.
And oddly enough, they even mentioned in the Arms and Equipment Guidebook that you can use it as an attack type role.
I've never had a player try that.
Well, and then they have a picture of somebody using it around the neck of a dragon.
That's hardcore. Okay.
I don't think I've ever seen any of my players use a grappling hook as a means of attacking a creature, but I can see where that could happen. Your example of the grappling hook around a dragon's neck is just one of many uses it probably has.
Yeah, because they're comparing it to using it just like you would to throw it around a tree branch or onto the roof ledge or a rocky crevice.
A very large benefit of using the grappling hook is your climb wall skills, if you combine it with the grappling hook and rope use, increases by 40%. And as climb walls is already a higher thief skill just as a base, that greatly increases your chancing of succeeding.
And for certain races that choose to be a thief, their climb wall skill actually is lower than others, so that would help if they had a grappling hook and rope.
What, that little halfling who has short arms and legs doesn't climb as well as a human?
Yep, same thing with the dwarf thief. He doesn't climb as well as a human or an elf either.
I don't think I've seen too many players focus climbing walls around a dwarf or halfling thief, but if they did, this would definitely be a useful tool for them.
An interesting rule added in the grappling hook is that if you use it and throw it through a window or you throw it onto a ledge that has glass shards, the glass shards will break the line of the grappling hook in 2d6 rounds.
So he better climb fast.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah, I would say that you would definitely want to climb fast in that situation.
So the grappling hook is definitely a useful tool. Ed, tell us a little bit about Weapon Black.
Okay, I'll read the description that is in the Arms and Equipment Guidebook, since I have it right here. This is an oily substance, and it comes in small vials or jars. Weapon Black is used to smear on the surfaces of weapons or metal armor to coat them with a pasty, kind of matte black finish so that it doesn't reflect light sources. Which would be great, because this also gives you a 5% bonus to thieves who coat their blades in it to hide in shadows. After typical melee, the weapon black will be wiped from it. It says if you actually strike somebody, the oil comes off, and then you'd have to reapply it. But there's also some additional penalties where if you don't remove it from your weapon and it somehow gets near an open flame, it's going to burn because it is oil-based. And if you don't drop the weapon, you're going to suffer damage of 1d4 for each round that you're holding this flaming weapon.
I've had one character take weapon black for that purpose. They didn't care if they got the bonus to hide in shadows. They wanted the bonus to the 1d4 damage that they hit when the weapon was on fire.
But they also suffer damage for having it on fire in their hands. Unless they have protection, like, I don't know, a ring of fire resistance, for example.
This particular thief wore gloves, which helped protect him from the fire damage.
That's fair.
The arms and equipment guide, it actually says, if somebody tries to consume this for some reason, like, hey, what's in this vial? Oh, let me try it by tasting it. It causes 1d10 points of damage.
Could be used as an attack, too. Throw it into a dragon's mouth or a troll's mouth and do a little extra damage to him.
I really like the amount of detail they put into this item. In the event that you try to eat it, here's what's happened.
I didn't see such an entry for the grappling hook.
True. We'll have to send TSR an email and ask him what happens if I try to eat a grappling hook.
Well, that would be kind of weird. You would look like a human fish.
The weapon black is an extremely useful tool for a sneak type rogue, but probably not so much for a trapper type rogue. It does have its benefits, but like it said in the description, after one attack, it wipes off. But if the thief is using it for sneaking, he's trying to get that backstab in, he uses the backstab and he just coats it before his next battle again.
I would find it very beneficial to use simply because it adheres very well. Clearly, it's attached to your weapon. You can have your weapon out walking around with it and it doesn't move off, doesn't roll off. So if, say, you run into a barricade that you need to burn down, you just smear weapon black over the side of the barricade and set it on fire. You can easily use it as a form of kindling because it sounds like it'll burn for a long time, at least 1d4 plus one round. So even if you don't use it on your weapon per se, I can still see it being very useful for dungeons.
That's fair. I never thought about that application. Most of my players will just use lamp oil or something along those lines.
Yeah, we're talking about coming up with creative alternative options for it instead of the intended purpose of an item, which you know players often will find ways to do.
And thus, it's a good idea to think about them.
There are a lot of items in the Tools of the Trade. I suggest checking them out. There's our take on the grappling hook and weapon black. Moving on to our last section, we are going to talk about playing and role-playing a rogue thief. I like the fact that the Thieves Handbook has added so many options for a rogue character. The original concept of the rogue was to be the person disarming traps and opening locks in a dungeon. But with the addition of this book, they've added a lot of different options and a lot of role-playing opportunities for a thief outside of being just the standard trapper.
Yes, the Complete Thief's Handbook does give you a lot of alternative options to just what everyone thinks of as the standard pickpocket, lockpicking thief that wants to hide in shadows and backstab people.
I think that they gave the rogue a lot of useful skills that they can use to create their character. They gave a base set of 8 stats that the rogue can use as rogue abilities. When the second edition came out, they gave the rogue the ability to pick and choose where they put their stats. In the first edition and basic editions of the game, they gave the rogue a set stat for percentile rolls. When the second edition came out, it was really nice to see that they gave them a little bit of customization that when they went up in level, they could divide whatever points they wanted between their stats. And then when the thief book came out, they gave them a little more customization with the thief kits, with some of the items that they can use. And then when skills and powers came out, they gave them a few more abilities that they could use that made them a little more unique to the rest of the classes.
One of my favorite uses for the rogue classes, and the thief in particular, is for multi-classing and dual-classing. I find that I've seen it used most often as a supplement to another class to add a kind of charlatan flair to a wizard or to add a kind of a dalliance to your fighter. And if you approach it from that aspect, a lot of the stuff in the Thieves Guide and just a lot of the things and skills available for the thief in general can make for some very creative additions to a character if you roleplay it correctly.
Yes, you guys both make valid points for what you can think of additionally to role-playing a rogue or thief.
Another thing that we covered earlier is what spells are useful to a thief rogue. We only covered 2 of the possible options, and I would like to list maybe a couple more that I've seen some rogues use in the past that were extremely beneficial. The first one on my list was the Nox spell. If a rogue is having a really hard time picking that lock, they can turn around and cast their knock spell and automatically open the gate for them. Because they're not going to advance as fast as a straight rogue, this is something that they probably want to keep one or two of on, but they only want to use when they do fail their lockpicking check.
I, too, had that same spell on my list for the same exact reason, actually. I was figuring if you fail on picking the lock, at least you've got the knock spell in waiting so that if you screw up, you can still get it open.
And it leaves your regular wizard the ability to memorize spells that'll be beneficial in other ways.
Yeah, that is true as well.
Another spell I had on my list was invisibility. I'm sure everybody can think of many ways that that spell is beneficial to a rogue. They can sneak in without being seen, do a backstab, they become visible, but they've already done their damage, so no harm, no foul. Attach that to the silence 15-foot radius, that gives them yet another bonus where they can't be heard or seen.
And then they wouldn't have to worry about failing on their move silently or hide in shadows skill.
Or weapon black, for that matter.
Yes, they wouldn't have to worry about having weapon black on and it getting near an open flame.
Useful spells that I find for thieves that I've seen used are illusions. I know that this was talked about last episode, but I had one player who was sneaking through a city that was on lockdown, and there was a curfew, and he was out past the curfew trying to get to another place that another one of the players was at and stuck at. And he ended up using, not as a thief, but as a wizard, he used Phantasmal Force to attract guards by making things appear in their peripheral to draw their attention somewhere else. And then once they went to investigate what was going on, he could move past them.
Another spell that I found useful for them is the Cat's Grace spell. It allows them to increase their dexterity, so if they're going through a particularly hard area, like they have to disarm a trap or they have to go over a beam, this allows them to gain dexterity so that they can move across. It operates very similarly to the strength spell, but it affects dexterity instead of strength.
Another spell that I have on mine is Forget. It is a second level wizard spell. And essentially, you cast it on somebody. If they fail their saving throw, then they forget everything that happened in the previous minute. So it's very easy to confront a guard. You perhaps subdue him, cast Forget. It's only verbal and somatic. You don't need any materials for it. And then you quickly move past before he regathers why on earth he's sitting on the floor. And then he'll get up, resume his patrol, and not even remember that he saw you.
Also useful against demi-liches, but we'll talk about that in another episode.
And I hadn't even thought of that, but what I had thought of actually was 2 second level wizard spells, blindness and deafness. You can cast them on one creature, so who the heck needs to worry about hiding in the shadows and walking silently? You just blind and deafen them and you can walk right by them normally and they don't even know you were there.
As effective as an invisibility spell is.
Well, invisibility combined with silence, but just in the opposite direction, casting it on what you're trying to sneak past instead of on yourself.
I only really covered lower end spells for this particular section because I didn't really think we were going to be getting into the higher level ones quite yet, but we can cover those in a future episode. Did you guys have any other spells that you'd like to talk about?
I have the 7th level spell Duo Dimension, which makes you 2-dimensional. And you can essentially use it to press yourself against a wall and slip into a crack or make yourself appear to be a painting, which it's 7th level, so if you're using it, you probably have something better, but for the purposes of a thief, I think this is one of the most entertaining options you can use to hide. And it straight up lists that if he turns sideways, he is invisible. If you turn your 2-dimensional end towards whoever you're watching, you can just pivot around them, and they won't even be able to see you because you're 2-dimensional.
That is a very fun spell, and I hadn't even thought of that one.
No, but there was one that we were talking about earlier this week there, but we decided to go with Alter Self instead. But you had mentioned something about Change Self when we were talking, Mike.
Change Self is a first-level spell compared to the Alter Self second level. So a first-level thief could actually use this spell to change their appearance and use it as a deceptive way to get away from a predicament.
And then myself, I have the Reverse of Light, where you can actually cast Darkness, or even the second level one, which is a darkness 15-foot radius. You could do that, and now you've got your own provided shadows to hide in.
There's a lot of spells out there that are useful for a rogue.
To that, I think we can all agree.
So that wraps up our Librum of the Player section. If you have any comments or any suggestions of what other spells might be useful to a rogue, definitely let us know at our email at librumofthedm@gmail.com. No spaces. or leave a message on our Google community page. And I appreciate all the comments we've been getting there. I appreciate the questions. But just to point out, we have yet to receive one email. Or you can leave a comment at our Podomatic website. For our next episode, we are doing a hodgepodge. We're going to talk about a lot of different topics that don't necessarily go together, but things that we thought were important to discuss.
And then after that, we might get back to some more themed episodes.
This is DM Mike saying, don't swallow the weapon, Black.
This is DM Ed saying, if you do have a flaming weapon in your hand, drop it.
This is DM Saul requesting to know what happens if you try to eat a grappling hook.